You know, Thursday was American Thanksgiving, and Friday is one of the largest shopping days in the United States, something like the Boxing Day they have in other parts of the world. And I don't know if you saw the news reports or heard about it, but there was one Walmart store where there was 2,000 people lined up outside waiting for it to open. They were there in the wee hours of the morning, and they opened it at 5 a.m., and the crowd burst through the security, pushed the doors down, and there was a part-time employee who was trampled and killed. And other people taken to the hospital because of injuries and being pushed around. It was unbelievable. They had lots of police there, but they just couldn't control the amount of individuals. Then there was a Toys R Us store, I think it was in California, where there was two people shot. What kind of world are we living in? I mean, Thanksgiving, you know, you think about the term and what's taking place in society. You know, society's coming apart. And over things like that, in a Walmart store, I'd be rushing to leave and get out and go somewhere else if it was me. But that's me. You know, when you think about society coming apart, I just thought about something. Has to do with my son-in-law recently who experienced the wrath of the deteriorating, once vaulted medical system in this country. He had this pink eye that developed into something far more serious, which we didn't know about when he was away on business. He came back, went to a walk-in clinic to see the doctor just to have a look at him, and the one doctor took one look at him and said, "You're highly contagious." She wouldn't come near him. Didn't really look at him, didn't check to see where all the glands that were totally infected and swelling and all the rest of it. Excuse me. So they gave him a prescription for his eyes and said, "See you later." So he came home, didn't get any better. The eyes didn't clear up. He was a real mess. Looked like he'd been worked over by a boxer. So went to another doctor the next day, another walk-in clinic. And the fellow said to him, "Well, I can't look at you because you're not registered with this clinic." Police. You know, so he came home and very discouraged, didn't know what to do. I think about an hour or so later, they took him into the hospital to find that they had to put him into isolation. He's got a very serious disease called cellulitis, something like that. The swelling of the tissue all around his head, in behind his eyes. They were afraid it could spread. He's still in the hospital after almost a week. But, you know, if he had been looked at earlier, if they had looked at him and given him an opportunity to diagnose it, maybe they could have arrested it. Now, it just shows you our society is coming apart at the seams. And our systems will not be able to cope with what's coming. It just is a shocking reminder of where we sit in terms of our systems and our infrastructure and how fragile it is and how vulnerable we are. Just incredible. And we haven't seen anything yet. We haven't seen anything yet. Recently, former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan and former President Jimmy Carter, maybe you've heard about it, were both going to be working on some kind of a peace program. And they were going to broker, or attempting to broker, some warring factions and disputes in Zimbabwe. But they wouldn't allow him in the country. They wouldn't allow him to come in to help them. You know, it just shows you the state of that situation. And I recall Mr. Carter also brokering a peaceful settlement to the war in the Middle East some years ago. And you may remember that. But there never was a peace process that ever lasted or ever really took hold for very long, right? Peace, peace, they say with wild abandon and enthusiasm. But it never lasts. It really never works in the first place. Just doesn't. Now, Mr. Clinton tried that. He had some, I think it was Anwar Sadat, some other people, Menachem Begin, at his office to broker a settlement. It was all smiles for the cameras and shaking of hands, and nothing ever took place. War still continued. Mr. Bush wanted to broker a peace initiative in the Middle East before leaving office. He leaves office in the latter part of January. It's not going to happen. It just isn't going to happen. The Bible says, peace, peace. It's proclaimed, but there is no peace. But then you say, well, wait a minute. Everybody talks about it. Everybody says that's what we want. They say we want it, so how come they can't do it? You know, you look at the news analysis, and you go to the website, and you can check it out and see what's happening in this world. and you realize how very fragile it really is. There's precious little peace to be found in this world, precious little. Lots of talk about peace in the Middle East, lots of talk, lots of things going on, but they've been fighting for generations. Same with Northern Ireland. Let's go and have a peace settlement, put the guns down, but nothing ever really changes. Of course, that situation settled down a little bit, but still there. The undertones are still there. Everything has political overtones and self-interest attached to it, right? All the conditions. Before we have peace, we gotta, here's my conditions. Meet all of these and we'll talk. But if we all want peace, and if everyone works for it, will we finally obtain it? Will we? And if not, why not? Why does it seem just out of reach all the time? Oh, they're finally going to have a settlement in the Middle East. Yeah, great. It's going to settle down. We can get on with life. And then it falls apart when the bombs go off. No such thing. It's always just out of reach. What is required to achieve peace? For the world and for the Christian as well. Well, the answer is the same for both, as we will see. What I want to look at this morning then is the reason why we don't have peace in our world. The reason why we don't have peace and what's required to obtain it. You've got the war in Iraq going on. You've got Afghanistan. You've got all kinds of other tribal civil wars going on. They're all over the place. You know, when you read about the shelling and the sniping and the bombs going off and people killing each other. And all the time, the various sides are saying, well, we're working toward a lasting peace as they shoot off the next round of bullets. We're working toward it. Various warring factions will not even cooperate with the United Nations. They send peacekeeping forces in, and they won't cooperate. They put roadblocks, they won't let them in, they disarm them, they make it difficult for them. So you see, they really don't want peace because the mindset is self-centered and it's driven by politics. Driven by self-interest, driven by greed, driven by all sorts of nasty things. Because you see, brethren, there is a satanic mind at work in the people that would conduct themselves in ways of brutality and torture and murder and humiliation, not caring who gets in their way, not caring how many people they blow up in order to make a statement like this situation in India, women and children being shot and killed. If you're an American or a Brit, they think you are, they start shooting. It's a wretched, evil mindset. So if we ever doubted it, you know, we are indeed living in the last days, aren't we? And always, so often, the victims here are innocent, defenseless women and children. They're the ones who suffer the most casualties. You know, things might settle down in Sudan for a while, like they seem to have a little bit, but we don't hear about it because everyone's got their sights on other wars. The war in the Congo, for example. But the attitudes behind the temporary peace of a ceasefire has not changed one bit because the bitter demonic attitudes are still at force, still working, and it'll never change until Christ returns to obliterate it. But the Bible tells us real peace can come only one way. Only one way. You know, at the end of the Second World War, many of the former top Nazi leaders, I'm sure people are aware of this, were taken by the Allies, and they were put into top positions in the newly formed government because they said, well, they might have been Nazi leaders, they might have been involved with the Nazi Party, they might have formulated policy, they're probably not the best people, but they're the best we've got to administer because they've got experience and to keep this country together and to rebuild it. So that's what they put them into these top positions to influence and to guide the rebuilding of Germany. But that mindset that they had was still there, obviously. As Mr. Armstrong talked about. And you know, ancient Israel was chosen by God to be a special people. And he gave them an understanding, and he told them how to avoid wars, how to avoid unrest, how to avoid internal disputes, domestic disputes, all sorts of wars and unrest. He showed them the way. Let's turn to Leviticus chapter 26. We'll start there. So if you're going to go to Walmart's for the Boxing Day sale this year, folks, be careful. God says there is a way, not a way that seems right to a man or to men, but a way that seems right to God. And if men would apply it, there would be great benefits attached to it. And that's just to people in general, you know, if they would follow the instructions. Leviticus chapter 26 and verse 1. He says, "You shall not make idols for yourselves, neither a carved image nor a sacred pillar shall you rear up for yourselves, nor shall you set up an engraved stone in your hand to bow down to it. For I am the Lord your God. You shall keep my Sabbaths," plural, "and reverence my sanctuary. I am the Eternal. If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and perform them, then I will give you rain in its season. The land shall yield its produce, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit. Your threshing shall last till the time of vintage, and the vintage shall last till the time of sowing. You shall eat your bread to the full, and shall dwell in your land safely." Safely. When people have everything they need, and more, for a good life, there's no reason to be envious of others and start a war, is there? Notice verse 6. "I will give peace in the land, and you shall lie down, and none will make you afraid. I will rid the land of evil beasts, and the sword will not go through your land." God says, "I'm going to give you peace. I'm going to give you rest." What's everyone doing today? Resting and relaxing, or are they out buying guns? Biggest business in the world is gun smuggling and gun running. Did you hear about the increase in gun sales a week after Mr. Obama was elected, the president-elect? Did you hear about that? They said that there was an increase of 35% in the sale of firearms in the United States and in some states in particular, because there was some concern about Mr. Obama tightening up the gun laws and being able to access firearms. So people are stocking up now. True story. Why? Are they preparing for peace or for war? They're frightened. Verse 6, "I'll give you peace. The sword won't go through your land." Verse 7, "You shall chase your enemies, and they shall fall by the sword before you." Verse 8, "Five of you shall chase 100, and 100 of you shall put 10,000 to flight. Your enemies shall fall by the sword before you. For I will look on you favorably, and make you fruitful, multiply you, and confirm my covenant with you." You can understand that the reference to the military here is because Israel was in the midst of hostile nations. But God took care of it. Five against a hundred. Amazing. 100 against 10,000. Those are some odds. But God is talking here about how he would give them peace and victory, and they would not have to worry about an invasion. Verse 9. Then he says, "I'll look on you favorably, make you fruitful, and multiply you. You shall eat the old harvest and clear out the old because of the new." It's just going to be so abundant. "I will set my tabernacle among you, and my soul shall not abhor you. I will walk among you and be your God, and you shall be my people." That's a very simple formula, isn't it? Very simple formula. No idolatry, keep the Sabbath holy, keep the commandments, and God will be in your midst. And you don't have to worry about invasion. You don't have to worry about internal violence. You don't have to be concerned about someone coming down to rob you. Don't have to be concerned about the crops not producing. There will be rain in due season. God said, "I'll take care of everything." Notice the contrast as we read verse 13. And he says, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, that you should not be their slaves. I have taken the bands that the hands of your yoke and made you walk upright. But if you do not obey me and do not observe all these commandments, and if you despise my statutes, and if your soul abhor my judgments, so that you do not perform all my commandments but break my covenant," verse 16, "I also will do this. I will even appoint terror over you, wasting disease and fever, which shall consume the eyes and cause sorrow of heart. And you shall sow your seed in vain, for your enemies shall eat it. It's interesting, it talks about consuming your eyes. This disease that my son-in-law has virtually closed his eyes, red, swollen, and they were concerned about infection in behind the eyes, and that's getting pretty dangerous if it gets in there. And so they thought they'd give him a CAT scan. If there is infection, they're going to have to go in there somehow surgically and remove it. Fortunately, that was not the case. But you can see all these crazy, wild diseases, bacteria, and they gave him intravenous antibiotics. They didn't touch it. Could not touch that swelling did not go down. It got worse. So it just shows you how these strains are immune. So I'll tell you, it's dangerous business. And we're just on the edge of it. We're just on the edge of it. It says here, and you shall sow your seed in vain, for your enemies shall eat it. Latter part of verse 16. How come it is that we have increased production off the land through the use of artificial chemicals and all sorts of genetic engineering, and yet hunger abounds? There's no reserves. We're in trouble. I will set my face against you, and you shall be defeated by your enemies. Those who hate you shall reign over you, and you shall flee when no one pursues you, out of fear and terror. And after all this, if you do not obey me, will I punish you seven times more for your sins. So God gives warnings here, real warnings. Notice verse 19. He says, I will break the pride of your power. I'll make the heavens like iron and your earth like bronze. You know, it doesn't say that you don't have power. It doesn't say that. It says, you know, the West has tremendous military muscle. But God says, I'm going to break it. And we've seen that happen. That has happened before our very eyes. I think the war in Vietnam started that ball rolling. And that war was such a debacle. Why? Because of politicians. They were running the war. You can't go here. You can't go there. You can't fly over here. You can't drop a bomb there. You can't do anything. And they were concerned about re-election, concerns, all sorts of things. And look at all the men and women that died. Thousands of them. And many more thousands. Excuse me, I'm not doing very good with my voice. And many more thousands wounded. Walking around today with one leg or no legs, whatever. Terrible. And the toll it took on them and on their families. And for what purpose? What purpose? What was the goal, and was it achieved? No. They could have cleaned that war up in a month. Could have. Every 4 years we have an election. And out of those 4 years, about at least half of that time is spent, you know, a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of effort, a lot of speeches is put into force to convince people to re-elect them. Desert Storm, remember that war a few years ago? Desert Storm was a brilliantly conceived thrust into Iraq. I read about it and watched it very closely. And it was supposed to be the reversal of the Vietnam debacle. It was supposed to be. But it was an incomplete victory because, you know, you can't be the number one power and not use it. And you can read through the rest of this chapter. And you see the destruction that occurs everywhere in every area because of disobedience. Notice verse 31. And I will lay your cities waste and bring your sanctuaries to desolation. And I will not smell the fragrance of your sweet aromas. And I will bring the land to desolation. And your enemies who dwell in it shall be astonished at it. I will scatter you among the nations and draw out a sword after you. Your land shall be desolate and your cities laid waste. Then the land shall enjoy its Sabbath as long as it lies desolate, and you are in your enemy's land. Then the land shall rest and enjoy its Sabbath. And let's notice verse 40 here. And And he says, but if you confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their fathers and their unfaithfulness in which they were unfaithful to me, and that they also have walked contrary to me, yeah, if you do these things, and that I have also walked contrary to them and have brought them into the land of their enemies, and if their uncircumcised hearts are humbled and they accept their guilt, then I will remember my covenant with Jacob and my covenant with Isaac and my covenant with Abraham. I will remember. I will remember and I will rescue you. God says there's still a solution. There's still a solution. In verse 42, the latter part here, he says, they will accept their guilt. Yeah, if they accept their guilt, because they despise my judgments and because their soul abhorred my statutes. There is a formula. God put it down there. That's the solution, obedience. So they have to get back to the simple formula we just read at the beginning of the chapter. And people say that you get the government that you deserve. You often hear people talk that way. Canada has a new government. Now, because it was a coalition government, a minority government, the opposition parties are now threatening to come together and to defeat the government over some particular bill and now put that government down and go back to the election. And you know what will happen? The same thing. It'll be a fractured government once again. What a mess. In the midst of all the turmoil, all the economic confusion, and all the downsizing, all the plants closing, and thousands upon thousands upon thousands out of work, they're squabbling, you know, to say who's going to have power. Where's the concern of the public servant to actually serve? No such thing. And people want to believe in and they want to hope for change that counts. That was what they talked about. That's what many of the candidates talked about. Change. We're going to change. We're going to make it better. We're going to make it good for you. And I promise you this and we'll promise you that. There isn't enough billions and trillions in the universe to meet half of those promises. I know there's someone somewhere who keeps track of all the promises, and they put a number beside it, a dollar number. I haven't found that site. I know it's out there somewhere. And it just amazes you when you go back and say, here's all the things you promised. They don't follow through. They can't. Change. Change that's meaningful and change that will last. And you know, I understand people's thinking. You want change. You want to feel good. They want hope. They want to latch on to someone or something, the party, the man, the whatever, the vision. It's going to get better. We'll kick this man out and we'll get better. And that's what they hang on to. But people are so gullible. And they believe the promises made in so many speeches. You ever watch these political campaigns and you see them when they're speaking? And the people in the audience are crying and hanging on to every word that they say. Just shows you that the spirit that's there with people, they want to believe. They need something to hang on to. But since God does not change, and since Satan won't change, predicting human efforts, understanding world conditions is not that difficult, is it? It really is not that difficult. True Christians have had their minds open to understand the Bible, understanding where human events are leading. And it's not leading to any goodness or happiness or wonderful change. I think we know that. And most people who never studied the Bible, they ridicule it. Treat it with scorn. And many who do read it don't consider the straightforward warnings for those who disobey. You know, at one time, here's some new doctrine for you. This is new doctrine. Are you ready? Turn up the tape recorder. At one time, God actually revealed himself and his truth to the entire population of the planet. Did you know that? Back when the world population consisted of two people. He did, though. Adam and Eve. Genesis chapter 3. You know, it's always important to go back to origins. Christ always did. When he was asked a question, he would go back and to how it was in the beginning. He'd say, well, in the beginning it was this, in the beginning it was that, or how it was intended in the beginning. That's how he would explain things oftentimes. Mr. Armstrong would always do the same thing. Don't believe me? Let's go to the facts. Let's look it up. Let's talk about it. God says, these are my Sabbaths. How is that my interpretation that it, I've got this wrong? It's God says it. Anyway, Mr. Armstrong likened our generation to coming into the middle of a movie. You come in the middle of the movie and you have no idea what happened before. You're trying to draw conclusions from what you're seeing, but you just don't get the picture. Okay, Genesis chapter 3. Go back to the origins here, verse 1. Now the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, has God indeed said you shall not eat of every tree of the garden? God didn't say that, did he? Planting doubt in the human mind. The woman said to the serpent, we may eat the fruit of the trees of the garden. Of course we can. But of the tree of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said you shall not eat it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die. What about the other tree, the tree of life? What we're focusing on right now is what she could not have, right? Isn't that part of human nature? You know, you focus in on what you can't have. She didn't say, no, there's two trees here, and one's the tree of life, and one's this, and one's that. She didn't say that. She said, well, we're told we can't eat that. Yeah, that's the way the human mind is. So Satan just jumps in, of course, and takes over and starts to work on her. Then the serpent said to the woman, you will not surely die? No, for God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened. You will be enlightened. You'll be like God, knowing good and evil. What's the matter with you, woman? Watching too much soap operas. And you know what? They liked Satan's proposition. That made sense. Kind of appealed to them, didn't it? To their human nature. After all, they don't need someone telling them what they could do or not do. Yeah, who says we can't have that fruit? Verse 6. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and the tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and she ate it, and she also gave to her husband with her, and he ate it. So, you see, they figured it was okay to eat the fruit. And this happened, brethren, after they had actual contact with God. Right? They had direct contact with their Creator, the one who would become Jesus Christ, before Satan even came along. As a result of these actions, this led, of course, to the flood that left just 8 people alive. Let's go to Genesis 9 here. There's a promise made after this flood that we need to remember. Genesis 9. And beginning in verse 8. Then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, and as for me, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, every beast of the earth with you, of all that go out of the ark, every beast of the earth. Thus I establish my covenant with you. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is my sign of the covenant which I made between me and you, and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. I will set my rainbow in the cloud, and it shall be the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Today we still have rainbows, don't we? It's kind of beautiful when you see one. Notice verse 17. And God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth. Why did Noah survive the flood? Why did he survive? The answer is in Genesis chapter 6, verse 22. Genesis chapter 6 and verse 22. Here's the reason why Noah survived the flood. Genesis 6, verse 22. Thus Noah did according to all that God commanded him, so he did. He followed the formula, do what God commands. How do you think that one man back in 1931 was raised up to do a worldwide work with no money in his pockets, no job to sustain him, no wealthy backers, no banks he could go to? He simply believed God. He took God at his word. And look what happened. Look what was accomplished. The worldwide work was accomplished. Regardless of what the people say, regardless of how he's torn apart and what he did, what God did through him, I should say. Look what was accomplished. Later on in Genesis chapter 26, we'll turn there. Another man that is famous in the Bible, Abraham, was also commended for the same reason. Genesis chapter 26. And verse 4, and I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of the heaven. And I will give to your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. There's the formula. Isaac would be blessed as Abraham was. And you know, in the dangerous time that we're living in, and knowing what is to come, obedience to God is the key to survival. And we're talking about physical survival, not just spiritual survival. We're talking about both. There is a key given by Christ about how people can survive and enter into God's peace. Let's look at it over in Luke chapter 9. Got in the car and we were driving about an hour away from the house and I couldn't find my glasses. And so I'm saying, what am I going to do? And so my wife gave me a pair of her glasses and I tried them on and it worked pretty good. Then I thought, boy, if I mess up, I can blame her. But I did find mine now, but I'm still messing up, so I can't blame anybody but myself. Luke chapter 9. We saw in Leviticus the need to keep God's statutes and ordinances. Another key is given here and is given in verse 23. But this is given primarily to Christians, those who are called. God has not called everyone at this time. We discussed that, the time order at the feast. Luke chapter 9 then, and beginning in verse 23. And he said to them all, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. And you know, brethren, when we were baptized, we said we would obey, even if it meant giving up our lives, didn't we? That's what we said. Verse 25. For what profit is it to a man if he gains the whole world and is himself destroyed or lost? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words, of him the Son of Man will be ashamed when he comes in his own glory and in his Father's and of the holy angels. Those people that are listening today have shown they are prepared to stand up for those words. And those words that have been rejected by the majority of people. And you know, brethren, today is a very dangerous and difficult time to be a Christian. You know, when we came into the church back in 1971, it was not a dangerous time, really. Not at all. But there were many occasions that forced us to stand up for what we believed. A good example. Today, it's no big deal if you don't participate in society's festivals like school and, you know, Halloween and Easter and all that kind of stuff. Lots of people don't do it. No big deal back in 1971 to be frightened, really, or saying that wasn't dangerous. It forced you to stand up. You see, I had to go and talk to the kids' school teachers. Oh, that was fun. Here's the list of do's and don'ts, you know, and you kind of go through it. And you also want to have consideration for them. That's the first thing you say. I'm having consideration for you in your classroom. I just want you to know and understand, and you go through it all. And it was met with joy. They loved it. Oh, your kids don't keep Christmas? No problem. How can we help? Not at all. We were met with ridicule and scorn from many. You know, when I lost my job over a holy day back in 1971, you know, there was no appeal to religious freedom. You can't do that. I got these rights I'm standing like today. And there was no human rights courts I could go to and appeal my case. I'm being unjustly, you know, put upon here. No, I'll tell you what it was. It was either you come into work or you're fired. That was it. That was the choices you had. So fired it was. It's happened to lots of people. But it was different times. It forced you to think differently. And there were many situations in those early years that made it tough. You know, it wasn't dangerous, but it was tough. And you either stand up or you fall down. You either have the conviction or you don't. You believe it or you don't. There were no easy options. There was all kinds of things happened to us in the early days. I'm glad they did, really. Didn't have to get dragged out. I guess God had to kick me and put me down and put me under and teach me. Still hasn't taken properly, but I'm working on it, you know. Lots of things happened in those early days that set you up and toughens you up for the future. Luke chapter 9 tells us what to do, although God has promised not to destroy the world with the flood again, right? He made it quite clear, I will not destroy the world again with water. And he set that rainbow in the sky as a sign it would never happen. He didn't say he'd never destroy the world again. No, he's going to destroy it because of human disobedience. And the next time, it'll be with fire, not with water. The destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah was indeed a type of what is eventually going to burn up the planet. Let's notice Luke chapter 17 here. Luke 17. One teacher said to me when I went to speak to him, he said, "Well, mean, Mr. Pimpy, you don't believe that Christ was born on Christmas Day?" I said, "No." But you know, and he said, "No, but everybody knows he was. The Bible tells you that." I said, "No, sir, it does not state that at all." Then we get a little bit talking about it, but you're really getting into areas I really don't want to with teachers. We came to talk about what we don't want the children doing. And it was tough on the kids, too. You know, being kind of set apart, set aside, something that happens. And you have to really take your time to work on that and ask God for the help to do it, to handle it the right way. Luke chapter 17, verse 28. Likewise, as it was also in the days of Lot, they ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. Everything was moving along as it always did in a society. Verse 29. But on the day, the very day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even so will it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. In that day, he who is on the housetop and his goods are in the house, let him not come down to take them away. And likewise, the one who is in the field, let him not turn back. But remember Lot's wife. Whoever seeks to save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life will preserve it. And I tell you, in that night, there will be two men in one bed. The one will be taken, and the other will be left. Excuse me. Two people, it should read, not two men. Two people, one taken and the other left. And the Greek word here for other means another of a different kind. A different kind. So you have to ask yourself, what could be different? What could the difference be? Well, probably talking about the difference between having God's Spirit and not having God's Spirit. I think that is probably the only thing that makes a big difference, isn't it, between human beings at that time, at a time like that anyway. Verse 35. Two women will be grinding together. The one will be taken and the other left. The word woman was not used in the original language. Two people, it should read. Verse 36. Two men will be in the field. The one will be taken and the other left. Two persons, not two men. Verse 37, it might be two men, but that's not what it's referring to, specifically in the original. Two individuals. Verse 37, and they answered and said to him, "Where, Lord?" And he said to them, "Wherever the body is, there the eagles will be gathered together." Now let's go to Job chapter 39. Job chapter 39. Job 39 and verse 27. He says, "Does the eagle mount up at your command and make its nest on high? On the rock it dwells in and resides on the crag of the rock and the stronghold. From there it spies out the prey. Its eyes observe from afar. Its young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are, there it is." Now let's turn to Matthew chapter 24 then. Matthew chapter 24. And verse 40. "Then two men will be in the field, one will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken and the other left. Watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known at what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. Who then is a faithful and wise servant, whom his master made ruler over his household, to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. Assuredly I say to you that he will make him ruler over all his goods." The same information as Luke, right? Same idea. And the same Greek word here, same meaning. To one side for peace and blessings. The person is taken into a peaceful relationship, taken into a place of protection, and the other is left. Now notice Matthew 22 in this regard here. Matthew chapter 22. Verse 11. "But when the king came in to see the guests, he saw a man there who did not have on a wedding garment. And he said to him, 'Friend, how did you come in here without a wedding garment?' And he was speechless. Then the king said to the servant, 'Bind him hand and foot, take him away and cast him into outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. For many are called, but few are chosen.'" And to paraphrase that verse 14, in this country during the winter, many are cold, but few are frozen. Just in case you didn't know that. Okay, back to Matthew chapter 24. Matthew 24. And verse 42. "Watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming." Watch here means to wake up. Wake up. "But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have taken care of things, obviously. Therefore you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you don't expect." Isn't that interesting? You know, when you look at these scriptures, So you think of all the ways it could happen, and then guess what? It's going to happen in such a way that we won't know. So that means we got to be ready. Because we're not going to necessarily have the definite, you know, to connect the dots. We're not going to know that. If it was that simple, we could just wait. God doesn't work like that. You think of all the ways it can happen, all the prognostications. I've heard so many situations that people have come up with. Ministers in different churches that have got doctrines and things built around a certain way that things are going to unfold. But he says, who is a faithful and wise servant when his master made rule over his household to give him food in due season? God is going to reveal it when the time comes. The point is here, be ready. The point is be ready. Be ready. In verse 50, he says, the master of that servant will come on a day when he is not looking for him, and at an hour that he is not aware of. Makes it quite clear here. And will cut him in two and anoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Eating and drinking with the servants, it mentions in verse 49, begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with the drunkards. What it's referring to here is spiritual drunkenness. And spiritual drunkenness is incorrect doctrine. And believing incorrect doctrine and teaching incorrect doctrine, as many have done. Remember back in Luke 17, it said, remember Lot's wife. Remember Lot's wife. Why do you think that story's there? There for a very important reason. But that's easy, isn't it? That's easy to remember Lot's wife. Yeah. What do we have to remember? What do we have to remember? Christ said, he who seeks to save his life will lose it. Lot's wife lost her life. What really caused her to lose her life? What was the reason? Let's go back to Genesis 19. Let's review this story. Here for a big purpose. It's here for a significant reason, if that's a better way to put it. Just reviewing this kind of brought this to mind. Genesis chapter 19 and verse 15. When the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city. Go, let's grab them and let's get out of here. Now, it appears that Lot had four daughters. Okay, the two mentioned here would be the unmarried ones. But notice verse 14, if you haven't looked at this before or hadn't thought about this recently. So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law, who had married his daughters, and said, get up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city. But to his sons-in-laws, he seemed to be joking. He's joking. What's the matter with you, Lot? Oh, real funny one, buddy. Yeah, okay. You know, what's for lunch? You see, the married daughters, or at least two that he mentioned here anyway, who stayed behind with their husbands. You know, they stayed behind and then they were destroyed. But the sons-in-law thought he was talking nonsense. Now why? Why? Why do you think the sons-in-law thought that he must be mad? Lot's gone wacko. Everything's been going on as it always has. What is the problem here with this man? Why did they not believe him? Remember the history of Lot? When Lot and Abraham divided their herds, and Abraham said, I'll go to the right, you can go to the left. Or whatever you want. You want to go to the right, you go to the right, I'll go to the left. Whatever you want. Abraham said, it's up to you. You choose where you want to be. He made it easy. Lot looked down into the valley, looked really good. He liked what he saw. And you could read about that story for yourself. So he camped near Sodom. And then you read on also where he moved into Sodom. He lived in Sodom. He moved, made the next step. And then it mentions he is in the gate of Sodom. Now, those who were in the gates of these cities, they were one of the city's leaders. Lot was one of the city's leaders. Why did the sons-in-law think he was crazy? Well, because he'd gone through all these steps, you know, living in the outskirts, then moving into town, then becoming a part of the leadership. He was a part of the whole establishment. Even though he was righteous, he was in that society. Not a nice one necessarily, but he was there. He kept himself pure and clean, raised his family. But his daughters were married to people who were in Sodom, at least two that it mentions here, or mentions daughters, at least two. What were their husbands like, I wonder? Normal guys? I don't know. Doesn't say. So when Lot said, let's go, they thought he was joking because he was one of the leaders. You know, and they must have thought, well, how can you have, you know, you've raised a family here, you're a part of the community, you're a part of the leadership, it can't be that bad. They didn't believe him. And the angel urged Lot in verse 15, hurry up and get out of here. Take your wife and your daughters and go, the two unmarried daughters. Only two daughters escaped. The other two married ones stayed behind. Notice verse 16. And while he lingered, talking about Lot, the men took hold of his hand, his wife's hand, and the hands of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful to him, and they brought him out and set him outside the city. Said, get out of here, right now. This is urgent. You're going to lose your life. And Lot lingered. Why? Why? His two daughters were left behind, and you can just imagine that. No doubt must have been a tremendous emotional moment for them. My wife and I have talked about that. If we're in a situation and we live to the point where the place of safety looms on the immediate horizon and we're granted that protection, and you think about your children. What about this? What about that? And you think about it, and it kind of tears at you because you don't want to see them have to go through certain things, obviously. You see, it was an emotional moment. And these biblical personalities, brethren, we read about are just like us. Just as fragile. Just as emotionally trapped in situations. Just as emotionally upset, or can be emotionally upset, and driven by all the desires that human beings have. Taking care of their families, running from difficulties, trying to deal with problems, whatever it might be. We're all the same. Verse 17. So it came to pass when they had brought them outside that he said, escape for your life. Do not look behind you, nor stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains, lest you be destroyed. Verse 24. Then the Lord rained brimstone and fire on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. So he overthrew these cities and all the plain, all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew in the ground. Verse 26, but his wife looked back behind, and she became a pillar of salt. How did Lot's wife seek to save her life? How? By staying in the society she was familiar with. Very familiar with. The one she spent so many years in. The society where all her ties and connections were. Where her married daughters were, where her sons-in-law were. No doubt there were some grandchildren there. That all definitely had a tremendous pull on her, right? It would on you and me. When she looked back, with longing because she didn't want to leave. For all those reasons. She's running, but she took a quick look back. They were told not to look back. So that kind of begs the question. How much do you want to leave this society? How much do I want to leave this society? That's the question. How much are we prepared to go through to break away from this society? How much? Could this situation happen to Christians in the last days? Well, remember this. The saints are, right now, and will always be the object of Satan's persecution. He has the rest of society right where he wants them. And guess what? He wants you, and he wants me. Now, we have other examples in the New Testament that show that when the pressure's on, many people give in. Many people give in. 2 Timothy chapter 1. The human desire for self-preservation is very strong indeed. People generally do not die easily. We attended a funeral not too long ago. Actually, more than one the last few months. And we've seen people suffer and slowly decline. And the desire to survive is strong. But is self-preservation the real way to peace for a Christian? Is it? We've already seen that he who seeks to save his life will lose it. We have to be prepared to give up for Christ's sake. That's the agreement that we made, to give our lives up when we were baptized. Oh, it's so easily said, yes, of course I'll do it. Oh, and so sincerely meant, yes, no problem, I mean it. But ultimately, we have to stand on those promises that we made. 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 6. Therefore I remind you to stir up the gift of God that is in you through the laying on of my hands. Now the gift of God referred to here is the gift of faith, brethren. The gift of faith. Verse 7. For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. And Paul's in prison writing this letter. You know, I'm sure there are people who said they knew Paul was in prison. People probably said, well, you mean you follow this guy, Paul? Isn't he that jailbird we've heard about? He's being persecuted, going to have to go before the Roman governments. He's in chains in prison. Are you a part of that church? How could a supposed good man be in jail? What's the real story about Paul? Why don't you tell me so we can all understand? Doesn't look good in the newspaper, does it? Doesn't look good in the newspaper. Paul's in prison. And here's a list of people you might want to look at that follow him. Would you want to have your name published somewhere? Say, here's the church where... See, the leadership can't run away. Mr. Bowles can't hide. Mr. Henderson, myself, Mr. Monroe, others who've spoken, we can't hide. I've never been a part of a church. No, are you kidding me? I would never do that. Oh, yeah? Sit down while I play this tape. We can't hide. We're out there. But let's say someone says, well, I don't want my name to be, I just keep me out of it. Just keep me out of it. Verse 8. There he says, therefore, don't be ashamed of the testimony of our Lord, nor of me, his prisoner, but share with me in the sufferings for his gospel, for the gospel, according to the power of God. The truth brings affliction. The truth brings affliction. Verse 9, who has saved us and called us with a holy calling, not according to our works, but according to his own purpose and grace, which was given to us in Christ before time began, but has now been revealed by the appearing of our Savior Jesus Christ, who has abolished death and brought life and immortality to light through the gospel. So that is where your peace comes from the truth of the gospel, which the world rejects. And which the world does not want to hear about. People don't want to hear about it. There might be some mild general curiosity about what you believe, but get into the specifics and see how quickly that child, I'm not interested in all that. That's what happens. Verse 11, to which I was appointed a preacher, an apostle, and a teacher of the Gentiles. For this reason I also suffer these things. Nevertheless, I am not ashamed. But I know whom I have believed, and am persuaded that he is able to keep what I have committed to him until that day. That day is the resurrection. Verse 13, hold fast the pattern of sound words which you have heard from me, in faith and love which are in Jesus Christ. That good thing which was committed to you, keep by the Holy Spirit who dwells in us. This you know, that all those in Asia have turned away from me, among whom are her Phygilus and Hermogenes. You know, he mentions two people very specifically here, doesn't he? Don't want their names mentioned? Well, he mentions them. Two people. Paul did it deliberately. He mentioned the names of two people who turned people away from Paul and undoubtedly turned people away from the truth. And then in verse 16, he talks about another individual. Verse 16, but the Lord grant mercy here to the household of Onesiphorus, for he often refreshed me and was not ashamed of my chains. But when he arrived in Rome, he sought me out very zealously and found me. He sought me zealously and found me. He was there to help me. He's telling us that people knew Paul was there, but many chose to ignore him. I don't want to be seen with him. I don't want my name associated over there. You see, brethren, when you belong to an organization, you become an extension of the organization. And if they start talking badly about the organization, they're talking badly about you. You either stand up for it, or you run away and hide. Verse 18. The Lord grant him that he may find mercy from the Lord in that day. And you know very well how many ways he ministered to me at Ephesus. He was not ashamed of Paul's imprisonment. He wasn't ashamed. I'm going to go down and help him. I need to go down there and give that man a hand. Give him some encouragement. Take some food to him, whatever it was. And no one knows how they will react when strong persecution comes. Or you might think you know how you would react. I might think how I know how I would react. Do you know how you would react? Would you say, well, what are you kidding me? No problem. I can handle it. I'll deal with it. I'll react properly. God will be proud of me. I'll never give in. Really? No one really knows till you're faced with it. We've had to face a few things over the years, but nothing like this. Nothing that threatened our lives. Our livelihood, maybe. Our friends, maybe. The thing is, Satan knows human nature because it comes from him. And he knows how people will say and do almost anything to avoid torture and to avoid death. He knew enough about it to make a proposition to God about Job. Let's turn to Job chapter 2 here. Job chapter 2. And Satan says, well, what about, let's have this test on your servant Job. Job chapter 2 and verse 1. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. And Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, well, from where you come? Where have you been? So Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it. He was looking for targets of opportunity. Verse 3. And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil, and still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause. He must have been quite a man to be mentioned in this way, as we know. So Satan asked the Lord and said, skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has will he give for his life. But stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, he's in your hand, but spare his life. So Satan went to work right away. Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with painful boils from the soles of his feet, of his foot to the crown of his head. He took for himself a potsherd from which to scrape himself when he sat in the midst of the ashes. His wife said to him, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. I love the words of encouragement from Mrs. Job. Thank you, dear. I really needed to hear that today. Yeah. You know, Job endured a lot. Job endured a lot until he learned the lesson that God wanted him to learn. God allowed Satan a certain amount of leeway, gave him a certain amount of authority, but he could only go so far. He couldn't destroy Job, which is what he wanted to do. And when the church was shattered and scattered, you know, God the Father and Jesus Christ found out what people would do, didn't they? And how they would react under pressure. Who do I believe? What's he saying? What about this? What about that? And all the things that people went through, as we know. And what we went through ourselves. A lot of pressure. I want to make the right decision. I want to stay tied to the truth. Understanding our foundation. Going back to the scriptures that kept us and held us there, that we learned. That's what we all did. And Mr. Bowles makes a point of tying us back to that foundation. Very important, very critical. Can never forget that. Luke chapter 18, verse 2. And there was a certain, there was in a certain city a judge who did not fear God nor regard men. Now there was a widow in the city, and she came to him saying, "Get justice for me from my adversary." And he would not for a while, but afterward he said within himself, "Though I do not fear God nor regard men, but because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she wearies me." She wears me down. Then the Lord said, "Hear what the unjust judge said. And shall God not avenge his own elect who cry out day and night to him, though he bears long with them? I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth?" Now, Matthew 24. Why would Christ ask a question like that? When the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? Will he find faith? Will he find very much? Matthew 24 and verse 3. Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, disciples came to him privately, says, "Tell us, when will these things be? What will be the sign of your coming at the end of the age?" This verse has some questions in it. And they are asked, asking Christ. And so let's look at one here. The one that says, what will be the sign of your coming? What's going to be the sign? And the answer begins in verse 7. "For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows." So we are living in the time of sorrows, aren't we? Verse 9. "Then they will deliver you up to tribulation to kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And there many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. Many will be deceived." Verse 11. "There are many false prophets will rise up and deceive many." Lots of deception out there. Lots of deception out there today. "And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved." And you know, brethren, endure or stand firm until the end. Saved means delivered or rescued. Delivered or rescued. Verse 14. "And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all nations, and then the end will come." We understand that's been completed. "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, whoever reads this, let him understand. Then those who are in Judea, flee to the mountains, and let him who is in the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house." There won't be enough time to pack a suitcase and to get your makeup bag and your hairspray or your electric shaver. Does that not remind you about Lot getting out of Sodom? Verse 18. "And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babies in those days. And pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. For then there will be great tribulation such as has not been seen since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be." Then comes the tribulation, and it will come suddenly. As we just read, verse 22. Unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. Then if anyone says to you, look, here is Christ, or there, don't believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. More deception, deception, deception everywhere. Verse 28. For wherever the carcass is, here the eagles will be gathered together. So you tie that into Luke 17 and Job 39:30. You know, and then that kind of brings it full circle. Then verse 29 then takes you to the time after the tribulation. You know, brethren, peace is going to be restored. Peace is going to be restored. It's going to be imposed. It's going to be forced upon people, upon humanity, by Christ when he returns. And Satan's going to be removed, and there can be a real peace at last. A real peace at last. Let's notice Psalms chapter 78. A few verses here in conclusion. Psalms chapter 78. Psalm 78, beginning at verse 1. Give ear, O my people, in my law. Incline your hearts, incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us. We will not hide from them their children. We will not hide them from their children. Telling to the generation to come the praises of the Lord, and his strength, and his wonderful works that he has done. For he established a testimony in Jacob, and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers, that they should take them known to their children, make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, the children who would be born, that they may arise and declare them to their children. That is what God intended. That's what God wanted to be done. All that information should be passed down to generation to generation to generation. Verse 7. That they may set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments. In verse 8, and may not be like their fathers, a stubborn and a rebellious generation, a generation that did not set its heart aright and whose spirit was not faithful to God. And that's the key to the change that's going to occur, brethren. It's an internal peace. An internal peace based on God's way of life. It's peace based on God's love and God's mercy. And it's a peace the world will someday understand and come to embrace. And it is a peace we can have now.